Again, that's The Big Sick, showing Monday, March 11th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage, under Community Events.
This is Ramona Africa, and you're listening to KBOO, KBOO 90.7 on your dial. KBOO is the exact example of the community taking charge of itself on the move.
Prison Pipeline presents a unique perspective of the criminal justice system, addressing the root causes of crime and broadening understanding of the institution of incarceration.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel? When everything goes wrong, you see some bad. But I'm just a soul whose intentions are good. Oh Lord, please don't let me be misunderstood.
You're listening to Prison Pipeline on KBOO Portland. This is your host, Isabel Sinclair, here today with Trevor Walraven, co-founder of the Oregon Youth Justice Project, and himself having previously been incarcerated for, if you'd be willing to share with me.
Sure. I was incarcerated for nearly 18 years, spread out over 9 different facilities in the state of Oregon, both youth and adult, both state and county.
So, Trevor, I thought we'd begin by talking about what brought you into this work, coming from the background that you did. Like, how did that process begin for you?
Sure. So, growing up in the system as I did, I went in when I was 14 and was initially released when I was nearly 32, and had about 5 years prior to release, become the president of the Lifers Unlimited Club at the Oregon State Penitentiary. And that really spurred advocacy in a lot of different ways. And it allowed me to liaison issues that arose within the population as well as administration there at the penitentiary. And so when I was fortunate enough to gain release, I was invited to speak at the Oregon Youth Authority's quarterly managers meeting 8 days after release. Which I did, and shortly after that spoke at the University of Oregon to a restorative justice class, and that just kind of continued to grow to the point of having given around 100 presentations since my initial release in early 2016, and many, many more than that, meetings and having conversations with community members and elected officials and everyone in between, surrounding my own lived experience as well as the issues that are relevant for today's youth and adults in our system.
So can I ask, when you first started speaking and giving these presentations, well, how did that change for you?
You know, I think as I have certainly learned more and as I've been able to transition back to the community, there's a lot of things that I'm able to speak to that I wasn't previously, because coming out again after having been incarcerated when I was 14, coming out in an adult, as an adult into the community, there's a very different life to live and many more lessons to learn that I couldn't know within my first week of release, because I didn't have a job yet, and I hadn't, you know, established myself in the community up until that point. So a lot that has changed, if you will, has just been through continued learning and education, and continued conversations with the people that I'm fortunate enough to sit down with.
What do you think is one of the key points that you try to distill about your own personal experience, or something that can help other people?
You know, I have come to recognize a tremendous value in making available resources for those who have been negatively impacted by crime. And while I've studied restorative justice in a variety of ways, I don't think it's necessarily for everyone, but I think everyone should have the opportunity to decide if it's for them or not. And I think for some people, you know, some individuals are better in a small group setting or one-on-one. Some need large group support. But as society has endured traumas, such as individuals, such as myself, has perpetrated, without there being a process for that healing to take place and for them to process through their own trauma and life, it's difficult, I believe, to get society to a place where we can welcome the more than 95% of our currently incarcerated individuals who are going to be coming back into the community.
Would you be willing to describe a little bit more about this process of restorative justice?
So a big piece of where I started engaging with restorative justice practices would be through nonviolent communications. And that, you know, it teaches empathy, and it taught me to see things very differently than I had previously. And especially when you go in young, you build up a lot of walls because the incarcerated setting is not one where you typically want to be vulnerable for a variety of reasons. And so going through NVC and learning to develop empathy in unique ways, and also recognizing that we're all individually impacted in different ways, and seeing people grow and have their aha moments through different interactions. And sometimes that's education. Sometimes it's a conversation with a family member. Sometimes it's a conversation with someone else who you're serving time with that, you know, shows you a different concept or expands a different perception to you that you otherwise hadn't been aware of. And so recognizing that for people in general, it's a different set of circumstances, a different amount of time, and there isn't a cookie cutter response in my experience to address those things. But there's a plethora of opportunity and options out there for people to engage with that I think can open the doors to the unique healing that is best suited for them. And that's how I think we need to engage, and without people understanding what resources are available. And I think without us being supportive, again, of both sides of harm and crime, of those individuals to find that unique fit for them, then it's going to be difficult to continue to create that healing that we ultimately want, I think, as a community.
I'm wondering, do you have an example that you'd be willing to share or could share that might illustrate what nonviolent communication is, or maybe how it had an impact on you?
Sure. So first of all, I'll preface this by saying the youth system and the adult system is very different in the way in which you interact with the correctional officers or staff at the facility. And so in youth settings, whether it is a county or a state facility, in my experience, those who are the staff in those cases are much more in role model positions, as opposed to in the adult system, where they are far more geared towards it's a job that they're, you know, putting in their 8 hours and going home. And I think part of that, it's easy, I think, for society to have a greater degree of recognition and desire to support and help a kid who they recognize is still developing than it is for an adult where they think they've made their decisions. And so understanding that dynamic, going and transitioning from a youth facility to an adult facility as I did, there was just a stark contrast in how you interacted with staff and the correctional officers. And I remember I had been involved in NVC for probably close to a year, and there was a female officer who was working a post that was out of class. So she was a corporal and she was working a sergeant's position. And she was also working one of the more difficult positions in the institution that had a lot of contact with everybody that was within the facility. And she appeared to be verbally aggressive with many of the individuals she interacted with. And had I not experienced the process of NVC, I would not have thought to consider what her needs were in that moment. But having had that experience, I was able to at least guess that she was probably feeling a lot of pressure being in a position that she wasn't necessarily trained to be in, and that her outbursts or her interactions that were arguably aggressive in nature were not likely personal or due to anything other than the stress of being in that position and knowing that it's a very visible position and it's a position that she has to do a lot of interaction. And she was probably feeling a lot of, you know, concern and desire for safety and wanting to make sure things run smoothly and, you know, wanting to prove that she can work this position so that she can continue to climb, you know, the ladder of the different ranks within prison. So seeing that and being able to empathize rather than lash out in response and rather, you know, to just recognize that she's probably feeling a certain kind of way. Her interactions with me and those around me are not personal in any way, shape, or form, but to recognize that and then to be able to respond accordingly and say, oh, you know, I'll come back at a later time or something along those lines.
So it sounds like nonviolent communication for you then was an experience that helped you better develop your own understanding.
And just empathize with that and, you know, recognize that that's a tough place to be in. So not to then pass judgment and say, oh, well, this person doesn't like me or this or that, but to really kind of recognize, you know, oh, I can relate to some aspect of that. And so I'm going to give her her space. And if somebody comes to me and says, hey, you know, what's up with so-and-so? Why are they this way or that way? Also share that perspective so that hopefully they can kind of see a different way of engaging as well.
So if I can backtrack for a moment, you had mentioned that what you think could be most beneficial in helping people to transition and in perhaps reducing recidivism is the availability of resources. So I thought I would ask, what does that look like to you and what do you envision?
Just creating a personal path for each individual and engaging on that level so that whatever kind of structure we see is successful, we can transition an individual out of that so that they can step back into the community in the greatest likelihood of success. If we know that, you know, I got a buddy who did over 20 years and had a very serious drug problem, long record, and him knowing that he needed to continue to go to NA and AA meetings so that his recovery maintains outside of corrections has been, you know, very important for him to make that transition and go to meetings as often as he needs to. So those recognizing where an individual's kind of safety needs to be, and how to help them maintain that as they make those transitions.
Something I heard you mention was this keyword safety. And I'm wondering, in your personal experience, did you find what that safety meant via your own personal work entirely, or did you also find yourself supported by the facility or by the structure there?
Yeah, so one of the things that I've thought a lot about post-incarceration has been, you know, this idea that you have a tremendous amount of time on your hands, especially for those with lengthier sentences, and, you know, recognizing that any Measure 11 sentence is going to be at least 5 years, 10 months. And when you put that in perspective, that's all of your high school years, you know what I mean? That's all of your four-year college years plus. And when you think about how much someone changes during that time, there's quite a big difference in who someone is at the start of that and who they are at the end of it. Or there certainly can be. And so in thinking about that and in recognizing that there is a lot of time to think about what led you to make the decisions that you did, and how to make better choices in the future, and how to have safety for yourself as well as those around you. But one of the things that facilities are, it's difficult or can be difficult, is a space of safety to do that reflection where you can be vulnerable. And, you know, I spent 12 years, so the bulk of my incarceration was at the Oregon State Penitentiary. And they have single cells, but you're not really alone in those environments because there's a very thin wall that separates you from someone next to you. And most of the cells are double cells, so you're going to share a space with someone else that you likely don't know prior to getting into that small space with them. So I think that from the sense of having the safe space to really reflect on your choices is really limited. And one of the things that OSP is doing right now is they're working on putting in a Japanese-style healing garden, which is just a tremendous undertaking. And they've already broken ground. They're working through that process. And part of what I have hoped for through seeing that continue to develop is that that may be one of those spaces that an individual can go to and visit, if you will, and sit and reflect on their choices in a more serene environment that might provide them greater degrees of insight. Here in Oregon, I think we have far less violence in our prison systems than many of the other states that are a little bit more known for that. But that said, you're still in an environment that can be very volatile, very quick. And you don't always know when that's coming. So there's, just as there have been more and more conversations surrounding correctional officers and staff that incur PTSD as a result of working in those environments, so too is that true for those who are incarcerated there. And all of that plays a role in how you're able to really reflect in a very meaningful way.
If you're just tuning in now, you're listening to Prison Pipeline on KBOO Portland. I'm your host, Isabel Sinclair, and I'm here with Trevor Walraven, co-founder of the Oregon Youth Justice Project, talking presently about his experience with incarceration and how he's used this to help others. So, Trevor, I'm wondering if we can use this space now to transition a little bit and talk about some of the current youth justice reforms that are on the table in Oregon. Would you be willing to share about what you find to be most presently important?
Sure. So there's four kind of distinct conversations that have been circulating for the past several months that I'm aware of. One of those is really looking to address our policy surrounding the application of juvenile life without parole sentences in here in Oregon. We are now in the minority of the United States that we have and use juvenile life without parole. We currently have 5 youth offenders who are serving true life, which means they have no opportunity for release. And so that is one of the kind of big talking points is really looking at how do we address that. Secondly, there are conversations surrounding providing greater opportunities for second looks, specifically for those 15 and 16 and 17 year olds who are convicted of Measure 11 offenses, and how do we move forward? And as it stands, a Measure 11 offense requires that individuals serve every day of, at the bare minimum, 5 years, 10 months. And therefore, second look is not an option for current Measure 11 convictions. And looking at, part of what we know, you also have to recognize that Oregon Youth Authority came around and was developed at the same time that Measure 11 came into effect. They both came in 95. And so we've had approaching a quarter century of data on how we do things differently in our youth incarceration. We're also one of 3 states that keeps youth in a youth facility up until the age of 25. Most states are 18 to 21. And so recognizing that it's oftentimes a detriment for a youth to transition to the adult court or to the adult incarceration system, because they're very, very different systems. And so the conversation, just looking at, do we provide individuals with a second look, even though they are convicted of a Measure 11 offense, so that there's an opportunity to release those individuals back into the community as long as we do not believe that they're going to be a threat. So, and along those same lines, there's conversation surrounding looking at youth, if they are going to be released before they are age 27, so less than 2 years that they would potentially have to spend in the adult system, to have an evaluation or a hearing to consider whether or not it's in the best interest of everyone involved for them to go to the adult system. Because again, you have a greater chance of recidivating if you're a youth offender that transitions to the adult system, as opposed to releasing from a youth facility. And your resources are different. The resources that you have potentially at your disposal are very different when you step out of a youth system as opposed to an adult system. And then the fourth piece would be looking at the automatic waiver process. And part of what Measure 11 did was it created a automatic waiver to the adult system, which meant that if you were 15, 16, or 17 year old that was charged with one of the Measure 11 offenses, that you would automatically be waived to the adult court, and there was no process for that. I myself, having been 14, I went through an actual waiver hearing, and there's a process, and you know it's established. And it's utilized, and it looks at many of the criteria that are, you know, certainly important in evaluating something like that. An amenability to treatment, likelihood of rehabilitation within a reasonable period of time, all of those kinds of things that they really want to make sure, you know, is someone going to, you know, likely get to a place where they can return to the community and be productive. So those are kind of the four primary pieces. Looking at that automatic waiver process, evaluation prior to transition to the adult system, expansions of second looks, and juvenile life without parole.
So out of those that you just mentioned for me, are all of these conversations happening simultaneously, or is there one which is most prominent to you?
Well, for example, if you did away with the automatic waiver process, then you wouldn't need to have second looks for Measure 11, 15, and 16, 17-year-olds. So part of it, you know, there's certainly a lot of conversation around Measure 11. Again, it's, you know, approaching 25 years that we've had that process in place and that law in place, which was voter-initiated and was voted by the people. And so those conversations, you know, I think we've really gotten to a place where we recognize that kids are different. I think that where there is more of a pushback oftentimes, and I think this is very unfortunate, but with our juvenile life without parole population, because I think typically people think of these individuals as monsters, unfortunately, and they aren't. They're people that I've done time with, and I know them to be very different than their worst decision, as I know myself to be very different than the worst decisions that I've made in my life. And so I think just because of, you know, that belief in kids being different, it's mostly looking at providing those second look opportunities, because there is a process in place that's used for non-Measure 11 cases that is second look inclusive, and we can see that it works. We can see the data on it. And just not wanting kids to have to be exposed to the adult system, or not wanting youth offenders to be exposed to the adult system, I should say, because when they're 25, they are far more mature and able to, you know, navigate the adult system than they are when they're kids. But it's still very different environments.
So, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems to me that Measure 11 is an integral part of our current incarceration system here in Oregon, mm-hmm. That many people are sentenced under Measure 11. I'm wondering, given this, how much of a change would it take to be able to have some of these options implemented? What does that look like for us?
Well, there's legal arguments on whether or not it would take a supermajority to legislatively change Measure 11 as we know it today. It could certainly be changed by the people through, you know, voting. I don't know if enough of our community here in Oregon that is out of custody knows enough about the issues to vote in a way that would really represent, I think, what people ultimately want. And let me further that by explaining that I think typically when you ask someone what their idea of justice is, and specifically when you're asking someone who's recently or even in the past been very negatively impacted by crime, is someone who's a harmed party in kind of the RJ language, or survivor, depending on how they wish to be identified. Their most prevalent response seems to be, and again, this is my own experience, that it's a number of years or a number of months of incarceration. That's kind of the response. But if you then ask the deeper question and say, just for an example, whatever the crime was, the person says they think 5 years is what justice is. If you then ask that same individual, okay, if we give this person 5 years and they step back into the community and they perpetuate that same harm on someone else, will you still feel like justice has been served? And universally, that answer has been no, because in my opinion, the root desire for those who have been negatively impacted is that those harms aren't perpetuated on anybody else, that nobody else has to experience what they've gone through. And that's not to say everyone feels that way. It's just I'm sharing my own experience and engagement in these conversations. And I think it's important to recognize that, because it's a very different answer to what justice is. And it doesn't mean that I haven't had people respond that they want some level of punitive kind of engagement with that. But at the end of the day, knowing that, again, the vast majority of our incarcerated population is going to be coming back to the communities, people want their communities safe. They want to have neighbors that they can rely on and not worry about. And that is very different than sentencing someone to an amount of time, regardless of how they come out, because justice is 5 years. 5 years, 10 months is measure 11 on a base level. And so, that's just a big piece, I think, of what drives me, is wanting to get to a place where we are sentencing individuals in a way that brings them back into the community with the most restoration that can occur for those who have been negatively impacted, as well as, the same being true for those who perpetrated that offense, so that they can come back into the community. And again, the baseline is not that we have people who are, advocates on all levels, but more that they come back in the community, they get a job, they pay their taxes, they are, hopefully they vote. That's kind of your baseline. Your baseline is someone that comes out and is no longer a draw on society because they're incarcerated, but instead they're contributing to society.
Thank you very much for sharing your opinions on this. It's been actually a joy for me to listen to what you've had to share so far. So we have a couple minutes left, and I'm wondering if there's anything you'd like to share about what you think people can do to contribute to creating this change.
As far as contributing to the change, I think conversation is really important. Conversation with any and everyone that we interact with, that at least scratches the surface of these deeper conversations, of what justice is, which is an opinion held by an individual, and it looks different because we're all different. So I think that's often my big ask of folks, is just that they have those conversations, that they be courageous enough to have conversations with family and friends and acquaintances, and that they honor the opinions that others have. And it's not about trying to convince someone of something different. It's just about sharing experiences or perspective that maybe another individual hasn't heard.
Thank you so much, Trevor, for being with us today and for being willing to share your thoughts and your experience. It's very valuable, I'm sure, not only to me, but to those who are listening.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Prison Pipeline on KBOO Portland. Listen to this and previous Prison Pipeline programs at kboo.fm/prisonpipeline.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel? When everything goes wrong, you see some bad.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Fixing Your City, creating thriving neighborhoods and adapting to a changing world, on Thursday, March 14th, from 7 to 9 p.m. at the Trinity Episcopal Cathedral in Portland. Fixing Your City, Creating Thriving Neighborhoods and Adapting to a Changing World is a book release and talk by urban architect George Crandall. He'll discuss Portland growth, congestion, and global warming, and identify steps the community can take to shape an equitable and resilient Portland. Again, that's Fixing Your City, Creating Thriving Neighborhoods and Adapting to a Changing World, on Thursday, March 14th, from 7 to 9 p.m. at the Trinity Episcopal Cathedral, 147 Northwest 19th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio, a proud co-sponsor of Deconstruction, an evening of Japanese food and culture on Sunday, March 17th from 6 to 9 p.m. at Two Strokes Coffee Company in Portland. Deconstruction is an educational evening of Japanese food and culture benefiting the California Wildlife Relief Fund. The event features Yuri Baxter Neal, Yuhet Sato, Megan Dinto, and a traditional kasiki meal. It will not be vegan or vegetarian friendly. Again, that's Deconstruction, an evening of Japanese food and culture on Sunday, March 17th from 6 to 9 p.m. at Two Strokes Coffee Company, 8926 North Lombard Street in Portland. This is a 21 and over event. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from McMinimum's Crystal Ballroom, presenting Galactic with Erica Falls and Lyrics Born on Saturday, March 23rd. Doors open at 6:30 p.m. and is 21 and over. Tickets and more information available at crystalballroompdx.com. Up next is Hard Knock Radio on KBOO Portland Community Radio.